Before I continue with any more readings, are there any questions? Yeah, so the question is around that sense of how to say something about how Ajahn Chah would can we just direct attention to ourselves and establish that goodness within ourselves, or how do we deal with people externally as well? So Ajahn Chah would make a point of really encouraging us to, one of course is that having that sense of as he mentioned in the teaching from Ajahn Mun, in the sense of being a witness for oneself, in the sense of having that internal knowledge and certainty and freedom from doubt within oneself of what is, what's good, what's right, what's beneficial. But also carrying that into the relationships that we have with other people. And that was living in a monastery, especially in a monastery with many people, contrary to popular belief, not everybody is, not even, let alone enlightenment, they're not even more peaceful. and some can be downright irritating. So it's just the nature of human relations, whether one's in the world or whether one's in a monastery. And being able to have an internal anchor that knows that, okay, this is how to establish peacefulness within myself. This is how to establish clarity or establish the internal goodness that uplifts and brightens the mind. Remember Ajahn Chah telling a story of the... And he was a great storyteller. And he would... telling a story of the good-hearted person in the village, he had some means, and he decided he wanted to do something really meritorious, so that he started to build a small meeting hall, which is in village Thailand. Whenever somebody would be traveling or there'd be some meeting in the community, you would use this communal hall. Or people would have relatives visiting or whatever, your house wasn't big enough, you'd have this communal hall that you could take people to. So anyway, he got people together, got the wood and the materials together, and he built this meeting hall. And then it wasn't shortly after it was finished and he died. And because he'd put so much energy, attention, effort, attachment into this little meeting hall, he ended up being reborn as a hungry ghost in the hall. And then he was concerned about his hall, and and then a group of villagers from several villages away came traveling along, and they came and stayed in his hall, and so they settled in for the night, and he was He was kind of happy that they were there using his hall, but then they decided to go to sleep as they would, and this hungry ghost who'd put all this effort into making this really nice hall was upset at the. They were just messy, and they're laying there, and this weren't neat and tidy. So he started looking at it. If we could just get them lined up nice and neat and tidy, then that'd be good. So he gets them all sort of pulls on one and pulls on the other and gets them all sort of neatly lined up along their heads. And I said, wow, okay, now that's like that. That looks good. And he starts to goes off to his resting place in the hall, and then he goes sees their feet. Oh my God, they're all messy. How'd this happen? So then, of course, he pulls them all down and gets them all in. Then the heads are all off. you get the gist. You're never going to get all these people all lined up and neat and tidy and in the same place. So that's in terms of living with other human beings, you just have to recognize that. You're never going to get them all the same, all neatly lined up exactly the way you want it to be. It's going to be, we have to have an internal guide, an internal witness that is able to let it be what it is, but then also not get swept up in the views and opinions, the proliferations and the various intensities of other people.
So it's a matter of your own practice.
Yeah. I mean, you've got to have an anchor in your own practice. You'd be good. Yep. There it is.
Okay. Sorry.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Did you, as a Westerner, ever have any difficulties in meeting Ajahn Chah in either with Buddhism or with Thailand, and how did that get resolved, or did it get resolved?
That's last night. It was Saturday night at the monastery, and because we give a talk every Saturday night, and because I've been steeping myself in sort of Ajahn Chah and reviewing, so last night's Dhamma talk was about Ajahn Chah. And as we're riding in the truck up the hill, there was Ajahn Karunadhamma said, "Oh, you got to tell that story at Spirit Rock tomorrow." So there's an opening. yes, there was a time when I was probably been about 4 range retreats at that time, so still quite a young monk. Lots of opinions, lots of views, then there was one morning a city monk and a lay person showed up at the monastery, and the monk, I had met him before. And I had my views and opinions about him. I didn't like him particularly. And so then he'd brought this Swedish journalist to the monastery, and he was working for some spiritual journal. And he was going around Asia asking various spiritual teachers just 3 questions. And then he's talking to me and saying, this is what he wants to ask Ajahn Chah. And he wants to ask Ajahn Chah, why do you practice? How do you practice? what results do you get from the practice? And, you know, which are actually quite good questions. And it actually gives an opening. Some, you know. But of course, my own views and opinions were such that I, you know, grumbling and complaining inside myself about this particular person. And then after the meal, we went over to meet Ajahn Chah, and sitting down and talking to him, so I had to act as translator, and I was the one who was around at that point that had enough language to translate. So they came and met with Ajahn Chah, explained, and so then I translated, but of course there's this internal dialogue going that I translated the questions for Ajahn Chah, and then he he just sort of started talking about something else. And then he after a while, he, you know, goes back and forth, and then he turns to me and says, "Did they ask some questions?" And I goes, "Yeah." And I said, "What were those questions again?" So I go, "Okay, why do you practice? How do you practice? What results do you get from the practice?" Say, "Oh, okay." And he starts talking about something else. And of course, this goes on another couple, three times. And I feel he's really putting the screws on me. And then then it comes again. I said, "What were those? They've asked some questions. Has somebody got some paper and some pencil? You should write those questions down." And so novice goes off, gets a paper and a pencil, and come back. And say, and he gets, okay, what was that first question? Okay, why do you practice? Okay, what was that second question? I'm sitting there translating. Okay. So what was it? Okay, what results do you get from the practice? Okay. And then he looks up and looks at the thing. "Why do you eat?" And then the person is, because this whole sort of scenario has been going on, he's sort of taken aback. He said, and he's not quite sure. He said, "No, why do you eat?" And he was not quite sure. And then the monk sort of steps in. "No, he wants an answer." He doesn't want a question. He wants an answer. He said, "Why do you eat?" He said, "Really, this is the essence of spiritual practice. I mean, we eat because we've got the suffering of hunger. And in the same way, we practice because of the suffering of existence. And we're looking for a way out. We're looking for a way to solve that suffering of our hunger of truth, the hunger for peace, the hunger for knowledge. And that's why we practice." And he said, "When we really understand that's what we're doing, we really see that clearly," he said, "that's when we'll start to figure out how we practice. We'll look for ways to practice. We'll find ways to practice." He said, and what happens when you eat food that's nourishing? You're full. You feel complete. You don't have that suffering of hunger anymore. And that's the result you get from practice. The suffering is finished." And so it's just that very, very direct and simple direction to that which could have been very speculative. And so that's quite a flavor of Ajahn Chah's teaching. And then also, sometimes putting the screws on his disciples and highlighting their foibles and their stupidity. Yes.
I'm curious. You're as an abbot taking care of your community. How do you handle it when a kerfluffle comes up?
Well, it depends. you know, you really, you really have to rely on patience. Is really the first one. Patience, and also you live in community, so you have to, you know, pay attention to what how others see things and how they're responding, and you know, getting some feedback or perspectives, because sometimes say an abbot doesn't see everything, and then really looking to ways of trying to find resolution through, yeah, what is it that's actually draws out wholesome qualities rather than just say reacting or responding really quickly to try to put out the flames or to, you know, to get rid of the problem, because it's important to really see it for more clearly for what it is, and not to respond too quickly. Because oftentimes that initial reaction or response is out of the discomfort with the kerfluffle. And we have to be willing to be present with it, which is actually the same way we have to deal with our personal practice. Because, yeah, there are usually our initial response. That's with when the Buddha outlines the Four Noble Truths. Suffering, cause of suffering, cessation of suffering, path leading to cessation of suffering. He also outlines the appropriate response to each of the Noble Truths. And the first Noble Truth of suffering is to be known. And the second Noble Truth of the cause of suffering is to be relinquished. And we tend to want to relinquish that suffering really quick and without knowing it clearly first. And then when we don't understand the causes clearly, then we can't relinquish it fully.
What are the antidotes for the next two, or the what you were saying?
The cessation of suffering is to be realized, and the path leading to cessation of suffering is to be cultivated. You know, those are the responses to those noble truths. Yeah. Okay, one more.
This is more of a practice question.
Okay.
When I pay attention, then I'm more aware.
When I am mindful, then I become more aware of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
I could just go into story and not know that I'm suffering.
Mm-hmm.
So why would we choose to become aware of the suffering?
Well, I think it's to notice the difference between actually knowing with awareness and knowing with proliferation, because the once we move into story mode, then there's no end to it. Whereas when it's something's known really clearly, it tends to fall apart. It tends to dissipate. It tends to dissolve. And there's a flavor to that that is very compelling. Whereas that going into story mode and getting entangled in all of the complications that the mind can spin out, it's got a very different flavor. And Yeah, the flavor of the end of suffering. Yeah, I like that. Okay, maybe I can do a bit more reading. I got a whole ton of stuff that I could be reading. And
come back.
I thought maybe one thing that's written here. Ajahn Chah set up his monastery, Wat Pa Phong, in the hot season of 1954. And it was near his home village. His mother and a brother and various villagers came to a place where he was practicing with the beginnings of a following actually it's now it's in a different province. Let's see, he was born, I think, was it 1918, if I remember correctly? He was born in 1918, so 54, 18, 36. Yeah, he'd be 36. Yeah. So he would have been a monk for 16 years. And his practice at that time was very he said he's talked about it at times where he said at that period before he went back he was practicing, his practice was going so smoothly that it just, you know, sometimes like our arms round, he just wouldn't feel that he was touching the ground. It was just so buoyant and light and bright. And one of the things that a few years before, his teacher, Lumpu Kinnerly, which you mentioned, had told him that your practice is going good, don't start teaching yet. And he'd followed that advice, and his teacher had said, yeah, it might be okay to start doing a bit of teaching now. So then his but it's just a bit of a background, a perspective that the Ajahn Chah that left such an indelible impression on all those who met him during his trips to the West in the mid-70s is for many the Ajahn Chah. That one. That was taken 1975, IMS, Jack was there. Most of the recorded talks that have survived were given during that period of his life. Most of the well-known photographs, the priceless seconds of footage in the BBC documentaries. It is a wise, chuckling grandfather figure with a pot belly and a walking stick that English and American Buddhists remember. There was something so genuine and unaffected about the warmth and wisdom that emanated from him during that period, something so timeless, that it was hard to imagine how he could ever have been any other way. But of course, he had changed. Looking back to the 1950s, a somewhat different Ajahn Chah emerges. And if it is an impressive and admirable figure that emerges, then it is also perhaps a less engaging one. Here is Ajahn Chah, the spiritual warrior, rather than Lumpa Cha, the beneficent king. To those who lived with him in the early days of Wat Pa Phong, Lumpa was a spare, stern, vigorous figure. The few photos of him from this period convey a sense of an almost frightening intensity, a honed and disciplined mind, unremittingly focused on its goal. If in his old age he was compared with a tiger at ease in his cave, at this time he might be likened to the tiger stalking his prey. It was a period in which he felt the culmination of his practice to lie within his grasp. Seeing the kind of momentum and intensity of effort needed to break through the wall of ignorance, he was in no mood for compromise. He pushed his disciples to their limits. Those who could endure it stayed. Those who could not left. He would tell them, Nibbana lies on the shores of death. It's good to sort of see that you know, this comes out of something. You're not born like that. As an example of a period during that time. Ajahn Chah would often say, patient endurance is the general of practice. You have to be really tough, he said, because this is not a light matter. It's heavy. One legendary episode that figures prominently in the history of the Wat Bapong Sangha is the building of the famous, or notorious, road up to Tamsang Pet. It's a branch monastery, but Ajahn Chah really loved the place. There's about 1,000 acres of forest north of Ubon. Ajahn Anaik, who some people might have met, he came here last year he's one of Ajahn Chah's earlier disciples. Ajahn Anaik's account gives a good idea of the challenges. We went to survey the route for building a road up the hill at Tamsang Pet. The head of the Ubon Highways Department said, if you're really going to go ahead with this, I'll send you a couple of engineers. Well, the engineers lasted 2 or 3 days. They couldn't handle the mamui, which is like poison oak. Oh. They said, this size project, you need a large budget. You need explosives, tractors. You can't do it by manpower alone. Lumpa hardly said a word. But after they left, we did our own survey, and then we got down to work. There is very little time to rest. We would start working at 3 in the afternoon and finish at 3 in the morning. Then after a couple of hours' rest, it was time to walk down the hill on Omsrong. It's about 5 kilometers down the hill to the nearest village. After the daily meal, most of us would take a short rest, but Lumpa would sit receiving guests until 3, when he would start working with the rest of us. He would hardly even get up from his seat. Even though we were all younger than Lumpa, nobody could keep up with him. We used sledgehammers to break up the large rock, smaller hammers on the fragments, and carried the rocks on our backs in bamboo baskets. Lumpa couldn't do the heaviest work. He was one of the rakers. The villagers brought gunpowder to get rid of some of the larger boulders. People from the highways department came to look, and seeing that we weren't going to give up, occasionally brought up some explosive. It was really tough. It was putting your life on the line. I suffered an internal hemorrhage and bruising in my chest. My chest felt tight. I couldn't breathe properly. I think that was the beginning of my heart complaint. The villagers who volunteered to help gradually drifted away until only the monks and novices remained. Everything had to be done well, well and quickly. If anyone started to joke or play around, he wouldn't say anything, but he'd immediately walk away. The following day, there would be a Dhamma talk on how to act like a monk, like a Dhamma practitioner. Whatever Lumpa did, he did it with absolute sincerity, and no matter how tired he was, never once did I hear him complain. There's also a story of the, also from Tamsang Pet, but this is from 1981. In 1981, Ajahn Chah spent the 3-month rains retreat period some 100 kilometers to the north of Wat Bapong at his hilltop branch monastery, Wat Tamsang Pet. Ajahn Chah was now suffering from a number of debilitating illnesses, and it was hoped that the more salubrious climate there would help him get some strength back. A small sangha would greatly reduce his teaching responsibilities. The remoteness of the monastery would reduce the number of lay visitors, which had now reached flood proportions at Wat Bopong. In fact, Ajahn Chah didn't get very much rest at all. Tham Seng Phet was by no means as inaccessible as it used to be. Most of the people unable to pay their respects to him at Wat Nong Bopong were more than willing to travel another hour or two to find him. By this time in his life, Ajahn Chah was too public a figure to find solitude so easily. Wherever he might be, people wanted to see and hear him. At Tham Seng Phet that year, it was the same. Somjai Chayalat, a laywoman who went to pay her respects to Ajahn Chah, recounts her impressions. Every morning, Lumpo would walk very slowly across the rocky area between the sala, the meeting hall, and the kitchen, receiving alms. As soon as he appeared, a crowd of people converged on him to put food in his bowl. Those who hadn't brought any food with them, or were too late to prepare it in time for alms round, squatted on the ground, their hands in Anjali, all of them expressing regret at not having the chance to put food in his bowl, ruining their luck. But it was all right. They would get the chance to offer their food in the sala at the mealtime. After the meal, everyone waited for Lumpo to come out and talk with the visitors in the meeting hall. There was a huge number of people and a steady stream throughout the day. In the evening, it was a bit better. Most of the people who'd come during the day had gone back. I listened to Lumpo give teachings from early evening. He didn't sit on the Dhamma seat, which is usually like a higher seat like this, actually, but at his usual place on the raised monk's platform. He taught in a relaxed, informal kind of way, interspersed with periods of chat with various of his guests. I remember at one point in his discourse, Lumpa was talking about making mindfulness continuous, and to show us what he meant, he lifted his kettle and poured out the water at first in drops and then in a steady stream. It was one of the similes that he was most fond of using in his talks. When it was time for Lumpa to rest, his attendant monk invited him to return to his kuti, his cabin, or sleeping cabin. We all just held our breath, afraid that he would leave us. It seemed like he had only just started talking. Lumpa smiled at the monk, but didn't get up, and after a few moments continued his talk for a while longer. The attendant repeated his request to Lumpa to rest, and we all groaned aloud. It was a plea and a protest. Lumpa smiled and said to the attendant monk, "I'll give them just a bit more." And he continued until finally it must have really been time, because when the monk invited him again, in quite a firm voice, he picked up Lumpa's walking stick and stood there with his torch in his hand to show that he was ready to take him back to his cabin. The attendant turned to all we lay people and said to us, "It's already far past the time." Lumpa smiled at us once more in a comforting way like a father. He said, "They won't give me any more time. I suppose I'll have to go." It was as if every single person in the whole meeting hall sighed with dismay. The time had flown by. It seemed that we had only been listening for a few minutes. I'd heard a Dhamma talk from Lumpa's own mouth for the first time, and I was utterly satisfied, but I still wanted to hear some more. So he had that ability to draw people in, he had that ability to just respond out of compassion. It was always the compassion that generated, even when it was obviously wasn't good for him, that was a hallmark of his temperament and how he both responded to the practice. I mean, he'd give himself to the practice. And how he responded to people. He just gave himself to people. Maybe I'll read a few things from sort of the Western, his interactions with the Western Sangha. In 1967, a Wat Bapong bhikkhu called Tansamai returned from a Tudong trip to the north of the northeast with an old friend who literally stood head and shoulders above him. Even the most restrained bhikkhus at Wat Bapong were unable to resist at least a surreptitious glance. The new bhikkhu was 6'3" tall, had blonde hair, angular nose, and bright blue eyes. His name was Sumedho. The two men had run into each other for the first time in Korea more than 10 years before, dressed in the creased white uniforms of their nation's navies, and now a second time, by coincidence, dressed in the yellow robe of the bhikkhu they had met in the meditation monastery on the banks of the Mekong River, just across from Laos, from Vientiane, where Ajahn Sumedho had recently been ordained. They exchanged their stories. Ajahn Sumedho told Somai how he had returned to college after the Korean War and gained a master's degree in Asian studies from Berkeley. After graduation, he had joined the Peace Corps and taught English in Borneo before moving on to a spell at Thammasat University in Bangkok. That it was after receiving meditation instruction at the nearby Wat Mahathat, which is next to the university, that his interest in Buddhism, born in Korea, had ripened into the decision to become a bhikkhu. Now, though after some months of solitary meditation in a small hut, Ajahn Sumedho was beginning to feel some frustration about the form of his monastic life and was feeling the need for a more rounded way of practice. Tansongmai's descriptions of Wat Bapong were opportune and inspired him. His preceptor, Ajahn Sumedho's preceptor, kindly gave permission for him to leave, and the two monks set off to walk down to Ubon, perhaps Sumedho feeling as if I was being pulled by a magnet. The attractive force held. Eventually, Ajahn Sumedho would stay for 10 years, form the nucleus around which the Western community of monks would coalesce, establish Wat Nanachat, the International Forest Monastery, before moving to England to begin at Chithurst in southern England, the first of 9 overseas branch monasteries. Someone once asked Lumpa whether he had any special connection with Westerners that led to so many becoming his disciples. He replied that his acquaintance was restricted to cowboy movies he had watched before he ordained. It was deja vu. When I was a small child, I went to see a cowboy movie with my friends, and one of the characters was this big man smoking cigarettes. He was so tall. It fascinated me. What kind of human being could have such a huge body? The image is stuck in my mind until now, and so a lot of Westerners have come. If you're talking about causes, there was that. When Sumedho arrived, he was just like the cowboy in the movie. What a long nose. As soon as I saw him, I thought to myself, this bhikkhu is a Westerner. And I told him that I'd seen him before in a movie. So there were supporting causes and conditions. That's why I've come to have a lot of Western kith and kin. They come even though I can't speak English. I've tried to train them to know the Dhamma as I see it. It doesn't matter that they don't know Thai customs. I don't make anything of it. That's the way things are. I just keep helping them out. That's the gist of it. When Ajahn Sumedho asked to be accepted as a student, Lumpa agreed, but made one condition, that he fitted in with the Thai bhikkhus and didn't expect any special considerations. At other monasteries in Thailand where this is Ajahn Sumedho speaking, at other monasteries in Thailand where I'd lived, the fact that I'd been a Westerner had meant that I could expect to have the best of everything. I could also get out of the work and other mundane things that the other bhikkhus were expected to do. I'm busy meditating now. I don't have time to sweep the floor. Let someone else sweep it. I'm a serious meditator. But when I arrived at Wat Bapong and people said, he's an American. He can't eat the kind of food we eat. Lumpa said, you'll have to learn. And when I didn't like the meditation hut I was given and asked for another that I liked better, Lumpa said, no. The whole way of training was that you had to conform to the schedule. When I asked Lumpa if I could be excused from the long Dhamma talks, which I didn't understand, he just laughed and said, you have to do what everyone else does. Not all of the foreign bhikkhus at Wat Bapong were from Western countries. Ajahn Koesako, for instance, was from northern Japan. After a period mountaineering in Nepal, he had devoted himself to learning yoga in India before visa difficulties forced him to leave for Thailand. Ajahn Koesako, too, was immediately drawn in. And this is him speaking. I arrived at the monastery just as the bhikkhus were leaving on alms round. I was very impressed to see them walking in a line, composed and restrained. I was transfixed. It was such a beautiful sight. It was something I'd never seen before. I walked into the monastery and found myself on a neat and clean path that was pleasant to walk along. There were no branches or leaves littering the path. It impressed me even more. I thought the abbot must be very good. He must have a very strict discipline. Ajahn Koesako's lay name had been Mitsuo Shibahashi, and Ajahn Chah, as he often did in such cases, made a Thai word out of alien sounds, in this case transforming a Japanese surname into the nickname Sibat Hasip, which means 4 baht 50, which is the currency. $4.50. Ajahn Koesako remembers vividly how Ajahn Chah taught him about the futility of the external search for experience. We're so foolish. We usually spend our lives chasing our shadows. If we were to spend as much time searching for our minds as we did for other things, then we'd already be a long way along the spiritual path. We're lost. Our minds are cruel, and we don't realize it. Our mind suffers, but we're unaware of it. We do nothing but add to the bad things already in our hearts. Wat Bapong is a place for eliminating those bad things. Here we devote ourselves to constantly searching for the mind and watching it. Sitting meditation, walking meditation, chanting. These are the basic practices. Everyone has to do these things. 4 baht 50, don't worry. You still got your eyes, arms and legs and hands and all your faculties. I guarantee that you can practice, that it will have benefit. Words of advice are just empty breath. You read something and that's the end of it. These things can't compare with practice. Start right now. You will find goodness and truth. And it's right there that you will discover the teachings of the Buddha. During the long illness at the end of Ajahn Chah's life, Ajahn Koesako was, while he was nursing him, expressed the gratitude he felt towards him. Ajahn Koesako, I felt as if he gave me new life. He was like mother and father to me. He gave me so many things. It was like I was slowly sinking into quicksand, just about to be swallowed, and he pulled me out and saved my life. My debt to him is so large that nursing him like this won't repay even a small part of it. There's more, but we can maybe just take this period of time to let the day settle and sit quietly for not quite 10 minutes.